of the Children and Families Committee to order. Good to see everybody today. You're all looking fantastic. Could I get a motion on the minutes from perhaps Representative Coulter? Have you reviewed the minutes?
As long as there are absolutely no follow-up questions, yes.
Representative Coulter tentatively moves to adopt the minutes from March 26, 2025. Any discussion, Representative Coulter? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. All righty. To kick it off today, we will kick it off with our great and noble executive branch. I will continue to chair the meeting from here, but I would like to invite anybody from the department who would like to kick off the presentation down to the testifier table. I will move House File 2436 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later omnibus bill. We also have the amendment here for educational purposes, if they will consider this when we assemble our omnibus, but I will not be moving the amendment, but feel free to talk about it. Mainly because I forgot to submit it, so don't read into that too much. So please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thanks. Good afternoon, chairs, members of the committee. I'm Ashley Reisenauer. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. So the budget for DCYF invests or dedicates existing state and federal funding and provides some new general fund resources to support program integrity enhancements, modernization of the child welfare IT system, federal requirements for the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, and addresses growing cost pressures for the agency. The governor's recommendation for DCYF includes cancellations or reductions in state federal fiscal year 25 that offset investments in the 26-27 biennium. As a result, the net impact to the general fund for 25 fiscal years 25 through 27 is a savings of $16.5 million, and the budget proposal also results in a savings of $7.7 million in the 28-29 biennium. The budget maintains progress made over the past few years to strengthen families, provide economic stability for Minnesotans receiving cash assistance during a crisis, support the child care system and families in need of affordable care for their children, and prevents unnecessary foster care placement of children away from their homes and communities. It does include two savings proposals, which I'll talk about in a minute, but does not include cuts to critical social safety net programs. And just a note about the formatting of the PowerPoint, we've written the cost on the left side and added a box at the top left to note the page in the biennial budget book for your reference. So for enhancing program integrity, these two recommendations invest $5.4 million in 26-27 and $2.8 million in fiscal years 28-29 to enhance program integrity at DCYF. This includes funding for a statewide electronic attendance record system for the Child Care Assistance Program and two FTEs in the DCYF compliance office. The governor's budget also includes a dedication of $10 million from existing DCYF IT funding to modernize SSIS. I know there's been a great deal of discussion about SSIS funding in this committee already, so I won't say much more about this proposal. There are a number of changes needed that need to be made to the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, in order to achieve federal compliance. The components of this proposal not only put us on a path to achieve full compliance in the future, but are also positive for families. The changes include capping families' co-payments at 7% of a family's income, which is down from 14%. In addition to reducing families' co-payment, the new tier restructuring would be easier to administer and less burdensome both on families and providers. The proposal also makes redetermination dates consistent for 12 months from the date of the last determination. So when a child is born to a family receiving CCAP, the redetermination timeline starts at the addition of the new child. Again, this makes the process easier for both families and for local agencies who are administering CCAP. In addition, Minnesota must require legal non-licensed providers to provide annual health and safety trainings. This training helps ensure that providers are trained to safely serve Minnesota's children and families. And then finally, the revised budget includes $200,000 in one-time funding to update Minnesota's Licensing Information Lookup IT tool, or LIL, to include pre-licensure inspection reports. This is something Minnesota needs to do to avoid being out of compliance with CCDF requirements. The operating adjustment increases DCYF's base appropriation to help address cost pressures. While it doesn't fully fund all of the projected cost increases, it does help to minimize impacts on current service levels. For example, the funding will help expected growth in employee compensation, insurance, IT services, and other operating costs. I know there have been some questions about some of the significant cost pressures or specific ones that DCYF will be experiencing. For example, DCYF has significant printing and mailing costs. We provide notices to participants in programs such as SNAP. And so with the increased cost of printing supplies and postage, the cost of those mailings is expected to increase by about $1 million next year. Some of the other cost pressures include cost to maintain our multiple eligibility payment systems that deliver our programs. So those types of systems rely on really specialized hardware as well as specialized IT staff. The cost of the hardware software used for our systems is projected to increase by $2.4 million in fiscal year 26. So while half of that is expected to be offset by federal reimbursement, we also need the other half would be a state cost. So again, DCYF will have to find efficiencies and use budget strategies such as delaying non-critical spending or holding vacancies in order to absorb cost pressures even with this operating adjustment. DCYF transition account reallocation is a joint proposal from DCYF and MMB. The 2023 legislature appropriated $10 million to support the transition to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Funding has been used for the Implementation Office to successfully transfer staff and resources to the new agency while ensuring seamless operations. However, we realize that some of the transition costs will not be incurred until after fiscal year 2025 when the funds are scheduled. So this proposal would extend the use of some of those funds through the next biennium. It also cancels $2.5 million to the general fund. The next two slides are savings proposals. So this first proposal represents savings from a decision by the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe not to join the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative at this time. As a result, the appropriation will not be used. During the planning process, the band identified multiple barriers to readiness and notified DCYF that they don't plan to pursue initiative status at this time. But DCYF will continue to work with the band and support their efforts if they choose to pursue initiative status in the future. The governor and the commissioner also recognize the Office of Restorative Practices is an important program, and the Restorative Practices grants are funding pioneering work in this space that makes a real difference. However, one of the difficult decisions made to address the impending budget deficit is to reduce funding for these grants by $1.5 million per year. This leaves a base of $1 million per year for the program, which will allow the important work to continue, although at a smaller scale. The next four slides include...
Representative, sorry, we'll take questions as they come. Sorry, I didn't tell the committee. Representative Sensenmura.
When you have a page number, what is that page number for
slides? Thanks. So the page number up in the upper right refers to the page number in the budget book for DCYF, the governor's budget.
In the bill.
We don't budget. Representative Sensenmura. Ms. Yeah. Reisenauer.
Thanks. So like I said, the next four budget proposals are budget neutral, and I'll just touch on them briefly. This proposal supports expanding authority for the Public-Private Permanency Collaboration, or PPPC, to include kinship services to support relative foster care and permanency placements for children and youth. Currently, only adoption and customary adoption are included in that. This proposal also seeks to strengthen protections for Native American children and families by removing the cap per grantee for the Indian Child Welfare and Special Focus grants. In addition, it allows tribes to work with the state to establish reporting timelines to reduce administrative burden and enable them to focus on children and families at risk of entering the child protection system. We have one proposal that includes the policy updates to the Teacher Education and Compensation Helps, or TEACH, early childhood program. It really just allows more flexibility in determining scholarship amounts, expands eligibility to include family child care providers, and reduces matching contributions. And our last proposal today is with the Great Start Compensation Support Payment Program, which aligns accounting structures to the Carry Forward Authority for the program by establishing a special revenue fund. This makes it easier and more transparent to manage the program. The proposal also makes all tribally licensed programs eligible for a 10% payment increase by expanding the access equity areas to include tribally licensed programs and programs that operate within tribal reservation land. I know there was a question about where these access areas are, and I believe we'll send a link to a live map online.
I've actually since found that map myself with my clever detective skills. So, onwards and upwards. Ms. Reisenauer.
Excellent. So thank you for the opportunity to present today, and looking forward to working with you as we move forward with an agency with the central goal of ensuring Minnesota's children and families thrive.
Thank you, Ms. Reisenauer, for your presentation. I have a quick question on the operating adjustments that are in my bill. So you mentioned the ones that have the federal reimbursement, which you have to line item those for the federal reimbursement, but I would like you to treat us like the feds for the other things included. You briefly mentioned them, but it would be valuable to know, like, precisely what's incurring those costs and how much for the larger ones. Do you have any more detailed information on those? Ms. Reisenauer.
Chair West, thank you. So there are three main cost pressures that we've looked at for DCYF. One is expected growth in employee compensation and IT costs. So we project that just the normal cost growth in employee compensation-related costs is a little over 2% next year, and looking at about 4% in the outgoing years. And then I mentioned our significant mailing costs, which are another substantial piece, and then our IT services, including hardware, software. We also, of course, include employee costs for those staff who have specialized IT skills and work on our programs. When we think about federal reimbursement, we do assume an average federal reimbursement of about 35% across our administrative costs, and that's accounted for in the proposal and in the bottom line. As I mentioned, the operating adjustment in the governor's recommendation doesn't cover the full cost of what we're projecting to need. So we do know that there will be other budget efficiencies that we need to find in the coming years to continue operating and maintain or minimize impacts on services.
And thank you for that answer. Do you have an estimate for the cost of expanding the 10% bonus in the Great Start Compensation Program? As we know, right now that program has $129 million allocated and a lump sum to sprinkle through the future years, but it's on a trajectory that people aren't going to be getting, providers aren't going to get the money that they got in the first year of the program. This actually doesn't change anything. We already know in the future that's going to happen, even with this bill. Do we know what the cost of increasing more people's eligibility is on the 10% bonus? Ms. Reisenauer.
Thanks, Chair. So this is a budget-neutral proposal because it doesn't expand the total pot of money available. So it does expand eligibility for some of the tribally licensed programs to receive that 10% increase, but doesn't increase the overall cost of the program.
Well, budget-neutral, but more money is consumed in a finite amount of money. I think that's very relevant to providers. So if it's moved into the special revenue account and we spend every penny of it from dispersing to providers, what happens when there's not the $129 million in change isn't enough to make it to the original $375 per FTE at a provider and more?
I'm going to invite our Assistant Commissioner Halsey up to talk about some of the policy pieces of this.
Ms. Halsey, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair West.
Proceed.
So as was mentioned, this is a nominal increase. There's very few actual programs that would be added to this that would be now receiving the 10% that are not currently receiving that additional 10%. So it doesn't really add a lot of money, and we'll be able to absorb it with the dollars that we have currently in that program.
So what happens when the program is So it's allocated $129 million, and the department expects payments to exceed $150 million. What happens when it's $30 million short? Ms. Halton.
Yes, Chair West. So the dollar amounts that we have right now, they are the estimate. So for instance, we have a certain dollar amount that providers are getting now. And as time goes on, we will look at that dollar amount to see if we are able to actually, you know, give providers that dollar amount as time goes on. So that dollar amount might be adjusted based on the amount of money that we have left. Meaning that the current dollar amount that people are getting, the providers are getting right now, may not be the current dollar amount that providers get if the money looks like it's not, you know, not there.
Okay.
So it's going to be an adjustment.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Halsey. I'm not positive you introduced yourself when you sat down.
Oh, I'm sorry. Diane Halsey, Assistant Commissioner of Early Childhood at DCYF. I apologize.
Thank you very much. I love hearing your name. It's wonderful. So that is just one thing I want to bring up is the Great Start Compensation Program payments are going to go down in the future as an individual, even if nothing has changed budgetarily. And I just think it's important for providers to realize the program is set up that way right now. And maybe I think it might be ideal to address, give some consistency in that, but then you'd have to right size what that number is according to the base appropriation. But that's not really a question. That's more of trying to figure out, looking at these spreadsheets, it's a very taxing experience, but I'm enjoying it well enough. Okay, I've hogged enough of the mic. Anybody else have any questions? Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you. The electronic attendance record keeping slide 3, is that a part of the provider hub or something separate?
Ms. Reisenauer.
The electronic attendance record keeping system, I believe, would be built into the similar platform as the provider hub currently is.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
So similar system as in it'll be like a module of the same IT system, or it's going to be a different program that connects to the provider hub?
Ms. Halsey?
Yes, thank you, Chair West. So the plans are for that to be part of the provider hub. So it will be, if you're able to access the provider hub, you'll be able to access the electronic attendance records. And there'll also be a way, I'm not the most technological person, but there will be a way, for instance, if you don't have a platform to, you know, gather your own attendance records electronically, you'll be able to use this to do that. So you won't have to add additional funds to your, you know, you don't have to pay additional dollars to get a system. You'll be able to use this system. And you'll also, if you already have one, there'll be several that it will communicate with. So you'll be able to kind of upload your data there as well.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that we're being efficient, not duplicating work. So thank you.
Well, that was actually a brilliant question. That made me, so the department is requesting a like three some million dollars and then 1.1 or ballpark going forward for the purpose of electronic record keeping. If that is something that's going to be tacked on to an existing IT system, I understand why there might be upfront costs, but where does the million-dollar appropriationist, what is that for if it's part of an existing system? Ms. Reisenauer.
Thanks. So all of our IT development costs, it comes with additional ongoing maintenance and operations supporting providers who are using the system as well.
Representative Katiza-Witum. Chair Katiza-Witum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to the slide about the operating adjustment and just get a little bit of additional information that you kind of initially addressed, Ms. Reisenauer. When we talk about the increased cost of mailing, I imagine that, you know, based on paper and ink and, I mean, like just the numerous office supplies that we'd have to provide in order to send out these mailings probably also includes, you know, a projected increase in cost of stamps and that sort of thing. Has the legislature over the last couple of years made any additional requests of the department to increase those mailings, or is potentially there some efficiencies that we're going to be able to find in posting some of these documents virtually? I know, you know, just private banking, personal banking, those sorts of things, credit card statements, people are always saying, you know, when you log in, like, would you like to switch to virtual payments? And I'm just curious if that's something that we have considered because, you know, it's not a giant amount of money. That's not going to be the reason that our budget is broken, potentially, right, in this committee at least. But it is a significant sum. And so if there are efficiencies that we can gain via the provider portal, perhaps, or this hub that we're talking about, just curious your thoughts on that.
Ms. Reisenauer.
Thanks. Yeah, you're right. The costs that are driving these costs are the things like printing, mailing, postage. And we're talking about mass mailings that are required to be sent to individuals when things like eligibility changes or their benefits. So I think, you know, it's challenging to find that level of efficiencies and to migrate something like that to a completely electronic platform. So these are some costs that we will have to incur in the near term.
Chair Katizawa, too.
Thank you. That's really helpful. You know, I do maintain some concerns based on what's happening at the federal level in terms of the conversations about the United States Postal Service and what that may do to the costs of not only DCYF, but all the other departments in Minnesota, residents, all citizens across the country, in terms of the potential privatization of this incredible and important civil service. So just wanted to flag that and see if the IT investments that we are making could potentially bring us some savings. And then, so you talked about there's kind of a 2% increase for some of the IT infrastructure, which probably just includes some of that ongoing maintenance potentially. And then with, I guess I'll just come right out. Is there any sort of COLA increase for our staff? Because this transition period has been really taxing. I know how hard they're working. I'm just curious what that looks like in terms of the operating adjustment.
Ms. Reisenauer.
Yeah, thanks. The operating adjustment doesn't assume any increases beyond what's current law. So it doesn't assume any increases that beyond what a person would be eligible through a normal step increase or those typical things.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See, a question for you in the bill. I'm just looking. It appears there's going to be about a little over $6 million from the general fund crossed over for operating adjustments for increased costs. And I'm just wondering, in the bill, is that in section Article 1, section 1.14, the appropriation transfers?
Ms. Reisenauer.
Sorry, excuse me. Thanks. I don't have a copy of the bill. The cost of that would be included in the our administrative appropriation. I don't have the transfer language right in front of me. I apologize. Though we do have in our appropriations article, we have standard transfer authority that allows us to make sure that we can move administrative costs and budgets where we need within the department to operate smoothly and consistent.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, yeah, thank you. No, I was just curious if you had in the bill somewhere, you can probably get back to it, the $6.176 million spending from general fund, transfer from the general fund for operating adjustment due to increased costs. So I was just curious what the increased costs were that you need to transfer the $6 million from the general fund. And I was just trying to locate it in the bill, but I couldn't see, other than in section 1.14 where it says appropriation transfers, and that seems to be the only place that indicates that it may be that portion of the bill, but it doesn't say a number.
Yeah.
Ms. Reisenauer.
Thanks. So the operating adjustment isn't a transfer, it's an increase in our base appropriation. So it'd be included in line 24.6, their total appropriation for the central office agency.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So out of the $113,569,000, that $6 million for increased operating cost is in that total. Is that correct?
It would be added to.
Ms. Reisenhauer.
Thank you. It would be added to our base preparation, yes, as part of our ongoing funding.
All right. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, just lastly, not to dissect this too much, but I guess that's our job. Just curious what cost, increase of costs is over $6 million for operating. Just if this specifics, and you don't have to answer that today for me, just off line would be fine. Just, I think when you have an increased operating cost of over $6 million, it would be good to know, well, what are they? Is it paper, pencils, heat and electricity, staff, cost of rent, you know, things like that.
So a significant cost of that is increase in mailing supplies. Also, there is some increased cost in their payment system and 2 to 4% increase in compensation. Well, 2 and then 4% in the following biennium or following year, and there's also increased IT costs. That was the question I asked to kick off this whole thing.
And I follow that.
Mr. Chair,
Madam
Chair, you guys are awesome. That's why they're the chairs. And if I was on time, I would have heard that, right?
Oh, I forgot you were late.
We appreciate you being thorough, though, Representative McDonald.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My question is related to slots, you know, what we're doing to increase childcare slots. This committee's, you know, children and family, that's a big piece of what we're doing, is trying to make sure we have slots. And I guess I'd like to hear some detail from you on what you see is the initiative for the department, because this morning when I was at Workforce, I listened to a presentation from DEED and the Office of Child Care Community Partnership, and it was surprising to me, I guess not surprising for the kind of calls I get, but the five-year data from 2019 to 2024 shows an increase of 15,589 slots for centers. And in the last 12 months, we've grown those slots by 654. On the family child care, though, we've lost 24,070 slots in 5 years. That's recent data. This is through the 2024 study. And in the last 12 months, families, providers have lost 2,129 slots. So to me, I'd like to understand what initiatives, because I don't see it in here, are going to be. What strategies and what initiatives does the department have in this new children and family? Because we invested over $30 million, and people are asking me, what are we doing for slots? How is it going to affect my community back in northern Minnesota, southern Minnesota, wherever they live? So if you could explain that, that would be great. Thanks.
Ms. Alzey.
Yes, Chair Wesson, Representative. So, yes, you are correct. Those numbers are due track. We are in a national crisis when it comes to child care slots. States are losing slots all over, and our state is no different. One of the reasons why, to understand how to build slots, we have to also understand, like, why are we losing slots? And one of the reasons, the biggest reason why we're losing slots is because child care is, some have said, a failed business model. It's really difficult to make ends meet if you are running a child care business. And so one of the ways to try to increase those slots is to try to stabilize the child care workforce in terms of the dollars that they are earning. On average, it is really difficult to have a living wage as a child care worker or child care educator. So some of the things that we have in place, there's a number of initiatives that we do have in place that are trying to tackle that very issue. Our Great Start Compensation Program, which we just talked about, is one of those ways, and is also, you know, being looked at as a national model, especially coming out of out of COVID. We also have other programs such as our Wayfinder, our ways that we can usher people into the, not only as a childcare worker, but also if you want to build a business, start a childcare, family childcare business, or even a center-based business. We have programs that are there to help you monetarily. There are many ways that people can be supported if they're trying to build a business in childcare. Having said that, all of that, we are still working on the issue when it comes to the wages that people are earning. And in fact, we were commissioned to do a report to the legislature, which we did, a wage scale report that actually details what it would take to get the wages for childcare workers at a level that is a living wage that will help to really not only stabilize our field, but bring additional people into the field.
Representative Zlesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. When you mentioned that it's a nationwide issue, and I understand that, do you have data in the department that shows the number of slots that Minnesota has for its per capita for childcare versus our neighboring states to present to this committee?
That is something that we
Ms.
can. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
How dare you,
Chair West? That is data that, if you're interested, we can put together and provide for you.
Representative Zlesnikar.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No, that is something very concerning about the ongoing business of child care. One thing I noticed about this budget is I don't see any money for early learning scholarships. That program has about $80 million a year currently, and I don't see it in this bill. What's the rationale behind that? Because I think that, as we're about to hear today, something that's very, very important to this committee and myself in particular. Ms. Reisenauer?
Yeah. I mean, I think the governor's budget represents some hard choices, and these are the ones that rose to the top, and I think there's more discussion.
I realize I did not take public testimony. Really quick, any member of the public wishes to testify on the bill before the committee? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Representative Hicks.
I have maybe got my papers out of order, so I do apologize, but I see the letter in my packet regarding the hunger relief in the governor's budget. Is there hunger relief in the budget, or is there not hunger relief in the budget?
Ms. Reisenauer.
We don't have any, this budget recommendation doesn't have anything specific to hunger relief in it, any specific funding for programs that are food support programs.
Representative Hicks.
I'm not sure what other people are experiencing in their community, but in Rochester, our Channel 1 food shelf, which actually provides food for most of southeastern Minnesota, and our food shelves had a bunch of trucks that have not arrived, and we are really in a bit of a pickle around our food relief and our food shelters, or food shelves. So I just wanted to clarify, because I saw the letter and we didn't touch on it at all, so I wanted to make sure I was understanding that there's no food shelf funding in the governor's budget. Correct. Additional food shelf funding.
Ms. Reisenauer.
That's correct. It's, of course, a high priority for the department, but there aren't additional resources in this budget for that.
All right. Seeing no more member discussion, I will lay over House File 2436 for possible inclusion. Next, we will go to Representative Peggy Scott.
Judiciary.
I will move House File. I'll move House File 2456 to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Good to see you, Representative Scott. I will just move your DE1 to get us going here. Is there anything you'd like to say about the amendment before we get the bill in the shape you'd like?
The amendment is pretty brief. It just clarifies the start date of the changes in the greater bill.
All right. So, any member discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Please proceed with your bill, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair West and Chair Katiza Watoon, for having a hearing on this bill. House File 2456 is legislation repealing the COLA-based adjustment for child support orders. By federal law, these child support orders have to be reviewed every 3 years in order to adjust them if need be. And currently, Minnesota is one of only four states that does this COLA every 2 years. And so this bill, I think, will make those adjustments more fair, more thorough. They will take a closer look at each family's financial situation. And rather than just an automatic COLA that may be unaffordable or maybe not enough, in some cases, this will take a closer look. And they'll do that every 3 years instead of every two. And one thing I've learned in some of the work I've done in the family law arena is that right-sized child support orders are the ones that get paid. They're the ones that have the highest rate of being paid. If they're way too high, the payer usually may have the tendency not to pay at all, knowing that they just can't afford it, period. So I have a testifier with me today from Ramsey County who brought the bill to me, and I think it makes a lot of sense, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for coming down to St. Paul. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Trish Skolpammer. I serve as the Director of the Child Support Services Division in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. Child support is heavily regulated by the federal regulations and the Social Security Act. And as part of those regulations, we are required to review and adjust orders every 3 years. But there is a piece of that that regulation that allows us to do a cost of living adjustment instead of those three-year reviews. And Minnesota, as Representative Scott has mentioned, is only one of a handful of states that continues to have a cost of living adjustment. The cost of living adjustment was created years ago, and it was based on a child support formula that only looked at the income of the person who is to pay support. And generally speaking, that support amount would be 25% of their net income. Child support has evolved over the years and now includes the income of both parents under what we call an income shares model, which makes the cost of living adjustment outdated. In addition, we do find situations where there are really high cost of living adjustments that increase child support in a way that is not commensurate of the increase in a person's earnings. So we saw increases as high as 14%. I don't know anybody that got a pay increase of 14% based on cost of living. So those orders get out of whack, and they're no longer right-sized, which makes them harder to pay. And then the reverse of that is if an order is set low because somebody has a low income and they receive promotions or get a better job, the cost of living adjustment doesn't address that need for a higher child support order. So instead of a cost of living adjustment, we would do reviews of all orders every 3 years, either through sending parents notice that they have a right to request a review or doing a review on all cases that include a child who receives MFIP as required under the federal regs.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Skolpammer. Is there any member of the public here who would like to testify on House File 2456? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony and move on to member discussion. Members, any questions for Representative Scott or her testifier? Common sense bill, sounds like to me. Let's do things, think about them before we spend money. It's always there. Well, not us in this case, but it's always a better way to do things. Chair Scott, would you like to have any final comments before we send this bill to your committee?
I appreciate you hearing the bill. I think it's, as you said, common sense, and I think it will help right-size child support orders.
Thank you. All right. I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 2456 as amended to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and you now have possession of your own bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We'll now go to Representative Curran.
Curran. Thank you for your work.
That's very good.
Okay. Long time we'll see.
Good to see you again before our committee, Representative Curran. Would you like to move the bill?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 102 be re-referred, recommended to be re-referred to the General Register.
To your bill, Representative Curran.
Thank you so much, Chair West and Chair Katoza-Watoon. House File 102, you might hear this a lot, but truly is a simple bill, adding a line in statute that allows administrative discretion to terminate redirection of child support services. So we already have a process in place where you can redirect support, but administratively, when it's in the best interest of the child, it can be more difficult to then terminate the redirection of services. So I'll turn it over to our testifier to do a better job of explaining that.
Good to see you again, Ms. Skopenhammer. Please, or Skopenhammer, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Trish Skopenhammer again. I serve as the Director of Child Support Services in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. Currently, under Minnesota statute, we are allowed to redirect an existing child support order to another person when that child lives with that person. And oftentimes, that could be a grandparent or some other caregiver, or it could be a foster care agency when the child is in placement. We are allowed to do an administrative redirection with proper notice to the parties, and there's specific reasons under statute why we can terminate that redirection. And what we're asking for this bill is to add another reason to the list of reasons why we can terminate, and that would be that it's not in the child's best interest, and this would be specifically related to those foster care redirections. And oftentimes it's not in the child's best interest to redirect because the child is, the reunification plan is for the child to return back home, and the family can use those funds to help rectify the situations that they need to take care of in order for the child to return home safely. And so this just allows us to do that administratively without going through a full court process and get the money where it needs to be.
Thank you. Is there any other member of the public who wishes to testify on House File 102? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And one little tidbit did just arise. If you noticed the shuffling and bustling, a fiscal note just came in on this bill, so I believe we are going to lay it over instead. Chair Katoza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so it sounds like there's been a fiscal note requested on all the related child support bills, and so instead of sending it to the General Register, we're going to lay it over. We can have some offline conversation on what makes most sense. Either this would go to Ways but on its own as a standalone, or if we would consider it for a possible inclusion. So I'll change my motion to lay the bill over.
No dastardly plots going on here, just to be clear. Representative Hicks.
I love this. This is one of those like make government work better, more efficiency bills that I love. I love this so much. If a child is with a parent who is no longer able to care for them, and there's a parent that's been paying child support, and the permanency plan is looking at that parent, we're giving the money. Like, just this is good efficiency government, making sure we're getting kids home with family. I love it so much. Thank you for this.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd love to love it, but I'm not sure I love it yet. So, and thank you, Representative Curran. Can you or your testifier, I always have concerns when we hand over situations like this to administrative decision-making. And I mean, part of the strength in our kinship programs, part of the strength of our child protection, our foster care programs, is the fact that we've got all these partners engaged. We've got guardians, we've got foster parents, we've got public defenders, we've got prosecuting attorneys, we've got judges. And make me feel better about, let me ask a question first. Is this the only administrative direction where money can be transferred, where dollars can be transferred? Is this it, or is there other times that administratively we can move support without having to go in front of a judge?
Ms. Scott-Perry.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to make sure I answer this fully. So in order to redirect child support, it either must be done through court order or through the statute that already exists, that already allows us to administratively move child support from what would be the custodial parent to a caregiver or the foster care agency. It can either be done through a court order or through this administrative process that we already have in statute. So we're really talking about the back end where we're trying to terminate that redirection because the child isn't with that caregiver anymore, or it's not in the child's best interest because the child is going to be returning home.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so who determines what's in the child's best interest in this, in the case that we're talking about today?
Ms. Scott-Perry.
Thank you. So the determination of the child's best interest comes from looking at the circumstances of the family's financial situation and also in collaboration with the social worker who's working with that child in a situation where there is a foster care placement. If there's no foster care placement and we're just looking at a situation where a child lives with grandma and doesn't live with grandma anymore, there may not be any social services involvement in that situation. It would just be sort of a common sense approach looking at where the child lives.
Representative Nadeau.
I still don't love it. I guess I'm having a hard time. How often is a judge not involved in redirecting support for children in these cases? Is it 90% of the time? Is it a small number of exemptions? I'm just trying to feel better about this. I don't like a judge not being involved in this for some reason. And I'm sorry, I just don't yet.
Ms. Scott-Hammer.
Thank you. So I don't know the exact number, but I would say this is a small percentage of the overall child support caseload. If I had to throw a guess out there, I would say that it's maybe 1% or so of our total caseload where we're redirecting child support for any reason. And oftentimes a judge would not be involved because somebody would need to bring a motion. And if you have a situation specifically where a child is just living with grandma for a while the parents maybe go through some sort of a crisis, there would not necessarily be a reason to take that to court. And the family may not have the means to get that into court. They may not have the means to hire an attorney or to navigate trying to be self-represented in an action like that. In terms of the foster care situation specifically, which is a huge part of what we're trying to accomplish here, a judge wouldn't necessarily be involved in redirecting child support anyway. They're more involved in the action itself in terms of placing the child, but in terms of where the money goes, that's often handled behind the scenes administratively through the child support agency in collaboration with the social workers.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you.
Any other member discussion on House File 102? Seeing, you want to tell a story, Representative Hicks? A brief story is more than welcome. Representative Hicks.
Okay, so I'm going to give you an example that I know of firsthand. Okay, so a mom really, really deep in addiction. A dad, a bio dad, who paid child support and had visitation. Unfortunately, he lived in Wisconsin, and he lived in a studio apartment, and there were three kids involved, right? So, and the way that mom's addiction panned out, kids needed to be removed immediately and moved to safety. There was a significant safety concern, okay? In that scenario, dad wants his kids. Dad can parent. Dad really wants his kids, but he's living in 400 square feet in Wisconsin. And so it's going to take him a minute to get a bigger place, right? He's got to end a lease. He's got to find a place. He's got to do some things, right? Well, the whole time while those 30, 60, 90 days that his kids are in foster care, he's got to pay child support to the county because they're in care or to somebody. Wouldn't we want dad to keep that money so that he can get that bigger place, end that lease, get his kids, and get those kids out of the system and back with their parent? We absolutely do. And that's why this works.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you for that example. And it, I think you can look at that both ways. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that, and I don't know that a social worker in Burnsville knows what the living conditions of that father in Wisconsin is. And again, I don't know. So that's why I'm more concerned that there is a professional adjudicator that is listening to the guardian, listening to the social worker, and you know, if there has to be an emergency hearing called on something like this, where whatever that support payment is, I don't, you know, it's maybe significant, it's maybe not significant. I just end up worrying that we're putting, you know, number one, a lot of responsibility, and you know, onto social workers trying to make decisions that maybe they don't want to make. And that's where my concern is. And I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just concerned if we're moving down that direction. And if we are, then I think we really need to start looking at where is it appropriate and where isn't it. What about if parents are using the example from the testifier where two parents are in dispute and the child's staying at grandma's, and now all of a sudden you've got, you know, orders of protection that get thrown into the mix. There's all kinds of things in our criminal justice or our judicial system that cause red flag. I'm not trying to make it more complicated. I'm just trying to make sure that we don't move away from what has been safe placement as to the best of our ability for kids. That's my point. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Lovely discussion for our committee. Representative Curran, would you like to close out your wonderful bill?
Yes, thank you again, chairs and committee members, for the discussion. I will note, and I appreciate too the update on the fiscal note. I was not sure where that was at, so laying it over is completely fine with me. And I just want to note as well, you'll see that the authors of the bill are myself and Chair Scott, who is just here before me. We literally had identical bills. We were working with the same folks and had a conversation about who was going to carry the bill, and I drew the lucky straw. So you get me today instead of Chair Scott, but I know that she's also in full support, and I hope this committee is as well.
Thank you, Representative Curran.
Thank you.
So Chair Katizawatoom renews her motion to lay over House File 102 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And now it's the time we've all been waiting for.
Okay. The next item on our agenda is House File 470, and this will be laid over. So, Chair West, if you would like to introduce your bill.
I will move to lay over House File 470 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, which could be assembled any day now. So, House File 470. This is a bill that essentially continues the funding that was brought forward in the last budget for early learning scholarships. And early learning scholarships are an incredibly important part of affordability for many, many families. And I've also heard from many daycare providers of the percentage of their clients who are there on early learning scholarships. I currently pay, $435 a week for my lovely daughter, Sybil, to go to daycare. And Sloan, in about 3 weeks, is going to be $485 a week. Unfortunately, I don't qualify for any of this, but that just gives you an idea of how catastrophically expensive daycare is, or childcare. There are more affordable options, but nothing beats the primrose of the lakes in Blaine. They are the nicest, most wonderful humans you will ever meet. And just a little story on that, because I'm very distractible, is when we left this other awful daycare, when we dropped Sybil off, she would not want to be dropped off. She protested greatly. The day we went to Primrose, she ran to the teachers. And at the time, we were like, oh, this is so nice. This is great. Little did we know. But that's when you have the right place for your kids, it's worth $435 a week, soon to be more than that. So this bill does have a $96.565 million appropriation for the next 2 years. what we appropriate for early learning scholarships will be less than that number, just to be fully truthful. But I will fight vigorously for us to find some money to continue this program as much as we possibly can. With the budget deficit, it does make it difficult, but I don't think this is a program that would be appropriate to let stop, especially as I have hearing from a lot of providers. So without further ado, I know there are a lot of people who would like to testify on this bill, and I think Erica Moss will lead us off. If I I don't have the list. Why do I pretend like I knew it? Right. Call up whoever's supposed to.
The first I have on the list is Corrine Martin. All right, Ms.
That's my daughter.
Ms. Martin, if you would please state your name for the record and then introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Corrine Martin. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Corrine Martin, and I am a mother to two beautiful daughters. One of them is right here. And I live in St. Louis Park. I am a recipient of an early learning scholarship, and I am here to express my support for House File 470 and urge members of this committee to vote yes on this bill. I first learned about early learning scholarships when I was in early recovery from an addiction to heroin and meth. I had finally gotten my youngest daughter, Oakland, back into my custody for a trial home visit, and we were living at Wayside Family Recovery in Minneapolis. Getting a scholarship changed our lives. It marked the start of our family's independence from inpatient facility programming and opened up new learning opportunities for my daughter and myself. I was able to work on getting my license unsuspended, filing for child support, joining a legal aid program, then filing for divorce, finding an affordable car, and then finally being able to lawfully drive my own car. I built a resume, got a job, and then I was finally able to go back to college. Things I could never do in my addiction were also things I could never do if I had to worry about taking care of Oakland for the entire day. Oakland's preschool has been instrumental in teaching her healthy ways to communicate and express how she feels. She loves being around other kids, and it's really opened up her vocabulary. Not everyone has a family available to help watch their baby, including me, and it puts single moms in impossible situations. With the astronomical costs of preschool providers, I don't know anyone with a baby or toddler that doesn't struggle to find safe, affordable childcare. Without childcare financial assistance options like early learning scholarships, there would be a lot more families having to rely on the county for help. And that just takes even more options away from families that already have so little to begin with. There are so many moms in recovery that depend on this scholarship, myself included. Without the help of early learning scholarships, I would be stuck at home all day and my daughter would not have the social or speaking skills she has now. These scholarships are a blessing for single parent homes like mine. I urge you to support House File 470 to show your commitment to supporting young children and families in Minnesota. Thank you, co-chairs and member of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Next we have on the list Athena Mijas. Hello, and thank you for coming in. If you would please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Athena Mijas. I am the Chief Financial Officer for Greater Twin Cities United Way. Greater Twin Cities United Way firmly believes that access to quality, affordable early child care is the cornerstone to academic success, positive health outcomes, and long-term prosperity. This belief inspired us to step into a new role, now serving as the first ever State of Minnesota Central Payment Administrator for the Early Learning Scholarship Program. This partnership draws on many of our existing strengths as an organization. Greater Twin Cities United Way has a uniquely deep body of experience in managing the kinds of payment processing and financial tracking that is required in this role. To access scholarship funding, child care providers complete an invoicing process to receive direct payments from DCYF for child care services provided to families who have been awarded early learning scholarships. Many providers previously struggled with this invoice and billing process. Until 2024, these functions were divided among multiple organizations representing different regions of the state. Programs and providers often had to send invoices to multiple area administrators for payments, and area administrators differed in their processes and procedures, which created additional complications for the providers. Based on recommendations from the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Task Force and following engagement with administrators and providers, DCYF opted to centralize this invoice and billing administrative function under one roof. Beginning with the state's 2025 fiscal year, Greater Twin Cities United Way entered a new role as this central payment administrator, providing a single unified payment processing experience for all providers across the state. Beginning July 1st of 2024 through the end of February this year, we have successfully processed 14,177 invoices for payment. We have paid out over $55 million in scholarship funds. We have served 10,377 children and supported 1,347 child care providers and programs. As well, we have processed about $2 million on average each week in payments. Over these past 8 months, we have streamlined the payment process, reduced administrative costs, ensuring timely and consistent payments to providers and programs, enhancing security measures, and facilitating the efficient collection of data to help demonstrate the program's effectiveness and impact. Centralized administration of scholarship payments has added capacity for the area administrators to provide effective, personalized case management for the scholarship awardees. This has made it easier for families throughout the state to access vital scholarship funds and to connect to their local resources, ensuring more children can thrive in high-quality early learning environments and at home. We have identified best practices and implemented security measures, such as fraud protection protocols, throughout our process, helping to safeguard public funds and ensure accountability. Our role allows for consistent implementation of program rules and regulations across the state, helping to ensure fairness and equity for all families. Investing in this newly enhanced proven scholarship program is a strategic investment in the future of Minnesota and the well-being of our youngest citizens. Thank you for supporting HF 470, Advancing Childhood Education and Support. Thank you.
Thank you.
On next, I believe we are going to a remote hearing. Allison Gettings.
Hi there. Can you guys see me and hear me okay?
Yes, if you could please, we hear you. And yes, if you would please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair members. My name is Allison Gettings, and I am the CEO of Red Wing Shoe Company. Like the rest of our testifiers here, I'm here today to speak in support of House File 470, which would keep the funding for the Early Learning Scholarship Program at its current level to avoid a significant cut. Red Wing Shoe Company is headquartered here in Red Wing in Goodhue County, where we have nearly 700 young children eligible for the scholarship program. Currently, fewer than 100 are receiving a scholarship, and we have dozens more who are on a wait list. Those might not seem like high numbers, but in a small county like ours, it's significant. When you take a statewide look, the number of children who are currently unable to get a scholarship grows to 8,500. And that number grows to 15,000 if the scholarship funding was not preserved. I know you all know that each of those children have adults in their lives whose ability to work depends on having access to childcare, like we heard a moment earlier. I know this committee knows how much quality early childcare access impacts families and our children's ability to succeed throughout their lives. And I wanted to take a moment to shed some light on why it's important for local businesses as well. Here in Southeast Minnesota, our available workforce is in critical condition. We have two jobs open for every adult seeking employment, and the demographic trends are not in our favor here. This has a direct impact on our ability to grow and thrive here in Minnesota. So access to quality childcare is fundamentally important, not only for parents and for families, but for businesses in our community to remove barriers for parents entering the workforce. Now, beyond immediate pressures like available workforce, as a business leader, I know what it means to face a difficult budgeting environment like the one the state finds itself in now. I have a big heart for that. In circumstances like these, I try to remain future-oriented and, like you guys, prioritize spending in areas that have the highest potential for return on investment. You all know that scholarships connect children in low-income families to quality early care and education. We've seen this kind of investment is shown to have extraordinary public return on investment because of reduced future costs to taxpayers. So one example are special education costs, which I know are a significant budget driver, have been shown to decrease significantly when we have early learning investments in place. So again, let me just share how this impacts businesses. In my community, when resources are tied up in special education costs, which is a real concern here in Red Wing, resources are then not available for critical educational programming. And we know this because they turn to our foundation, our Red Wing Shoe Company Foundation, to cover gaps, like hiring tutors to teach kids how to read and funding STEM programs. Moreover, when the schools struggle, we struggle as a business as well to attract potential employees with families to come to our community to work. And we also struggle to hire quality candidates from our community to work. I know from my peers that these are issues that aren't just in Red Wing. These are echoed statewide.
If you could wrap up, please.
Well, that was my main pitch, Chair. Thank you so much for your time today. The work you do matters a lot, and I'm appreciative of the time that you gave me.
All right. Thank you. Next, we will go to, and I'm going to butcher this name, and I apologize in advance, but Viri Diana and Anguiano.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair West and members of the committee. Can you hear me well?
Yes. Yeah, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes. My name is Viridiana Anguiano, and I'm the program director for Listos Preschool and Childcare here in Rochester, Minnesota. I'd like to express my full gratitude, first of all, to the legislators who had the foresight to increase the funding for early learning scholarships to its current level. And I really urge you to support House File 470 to maintain these levels of funding. This school year here at Listos, 14 of our 37 students receive early learning scholarships currently. That is almost 40% of our enrollment, so it would really greatly affect us. These children are given the opportunity to have a high quality childcare experience at our center. We are a 4-star parent aware rated program. Unfortunately, many other children do not have this fortunate to be in. Since September, our program has helped 9 other families submit their scholarship applications, only for them to be put on an ever-growing waiting list. Maintaining scholarship funding is critical not only for the success of the children who receive them, but also for programs like ours who serve them. For the first time in 10 years, we are finally working with a balanced budget. So previously, a child with an early learning scholarship would receive about $8,500 to cover 12 months of tuition. Our tuition at that time was $14,800. So for the past 10 years, we've held fundraisers and kept our staff wages extremely low so that we could make up that difference. We were subsidizing childcare. 2 years ago, our center's budget was so short that we had to implement a wage freeze. And within months, we had lost 3 of our teachers due to this. So reducing funding of early learning scholarships would have a devastating impact on Minnesotans who already have a fragile childcare system, with more children that are being left on the wait list, and destabilizing childcare programs like ours, which are finally on a stable footing. So I am calling you to support and fully fund early learning scholarships by voting for House File 470. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Now we will move to public testimony. And do we have any? Okay, seeing none. So now we can go to member questions. And Representative Sensermira.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair West, for authoring this bill. Just being new to the committee, I'm wondering if you can kind of talk to me about the differences between CCAP and early learning scholarships, and for early learning scholarships, kind of how much are families who are participating, how much do they get from the scholarship? Is it like a monthly payment? Is it an annual payment? Just a little bit more details about the program. Thank you.
Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sensermira. CCAP follows the child and goes directly to the provider. Early learning scholarships has two different routes, pathway one, pathway two. One goes to the provider, the other goes to follows the child. And how much do they get? I believe it's tied to a median income thing, but that might be a question for Annie Mock or Doug Berg. Or Erica Moss appears from the shadows.
You can always play fun.
Thank you. If you would... please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Erica Moss from Think Small. Mr. Chair and Representative Sensermira, in 2023, the legislature made the wise decision to match up the amounts for scholarships and child care assistance, so they are similar.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you speak to just, is there like an average amount that a family gets, or does it differ depending on income? Thank you.
Ms. Moss.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sensermira, the average scholarship amount right now is about $15,000 per child per year. That's a statewide amount, and the money follows children to the program of their family's choice, so it's a mix of child care centers, family child care homes, school-based pre-K and Head Start programs all serve scholarship kids. I'm not sure how that compares to CCAP. CCAP has a little bit of a difference, like how much it costs to serve the family, so there's not a direct comparison there.
Representative Sensermira.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many young people or families are currently getting the scholarship? Thank you.
Ms. Moss.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sensermira, my understanding is that at this time there are about 10,500 scholarship recipients in a given month in the state of Minnesota.
Sensermira.
Yeah, thank you. So I'll just make a couple comments. I'm very much in support of this bill. I'm a co-author, Chair West. I believe that by starting this program, like, we've made a commitment to families, and I think we need to follow through on that commitment. What I just heard you say was that would be 10,000 young people that would be, lacking the quality childcare that they need. I'm disappointed that this is not in the DCYF budget. I'm glad that you are advocating for it. I do want to kind of make a link to the conversation we're having here and a conversation that the Workforce Development Committee was having earlier, as Representative Lesnikar alluded to. There I actually had a bill that was would give childcare workers who are currently on the waiting list for early learning scholarships free or subsidized childcare. And so I think it's really important, in this committee that we are always holding the two goals that we have, affordable childcare for families and making sure that childcare workers have a living wage. We need to do both of those, right? So much of the time we are looking to do one of those things at the expense of the other. And so I think we just need to hold that, right? Like, the fact that we have people who are working in our childcare centers doing this most important work of caring for our youngest, often most vulnerable people in our community, and they don't, they qualify for this low income scholarship because they are not making enough. I think we just need to sit with that reality. I very much support this proposal. I think we need to continue this program. And, Chair West, I heard you talk about, the experience that you had watching your daughter go to a really high quality, childcare place. And I said this morning when I was talking about my bill in Workforce for Childcare Workers, that when I pay my monthly, bill for childcare, it is more than I would like to pay, and it is the most uncomplicated payment that I ever make, because good childcare is priceless, right? And making sure, and I I think with the stories that we are hearing in this session on this committee, like having a safe place for our young people to go is priceless. So thank you, Chair West, for bringing this bill.
Other comments, questions? McDonald, Representative McDonald, are you pondering or are you ready?
Thank you. I was just regarding, just hesitating if I should speak at all, but do a question for probably the department. Just the cost of it to administer is around $4,266,000, I see, according to my information. And that's less than maybe 3 or 4% of admin, which is usually pretty good, I guess. But I was just curious, some of the particulars on administering these grants for early childhood. It's a big ask. It's an important ask, Representative Nolan, your Chair Nolan. But at $4,266,000 to administer, still a lot of money, right? But just curious as to some of the procedures and of the cost of that, Mr. Chair. That's why I hesitated whether or not to ask.
Yeah. Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald. Well, I think I did hear that the United Way does facilitate these payments in an earlier testifier. I don't know if they're still here, but I think the department could provide some insight on that, which newly is the United Way develop processing their payments between the different entities. But
go ahead, Shana.
Come hither.
Thank you, and if you would introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, Shana Morris, Legislative Director for Early Childhood at DCYF, and I heard the question was about the administrative costs for the program. There's sort of a couple of different buckets I think that we could put them in. Statute provides an administrative portion annually for the department, and that's about $2.1 million. There's also funding that is provided to the area administrators as well as the third-party payment provider. And I don't have those numbers in front of me, but happy to follow up with what those are.
Representative McDonald, follow up. Okay. Representative Alton, Altendorf.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair West, for bringing this forward. And I just want to put my, you know, support behind this, but as legislators, lots of times, you know, we do things and then down the road there's an unintended consequence. And as we're hearing, I mean, this is quite impressive, you know, the amount of people, organizations that are supporting this bill. We heard testifiers, the Red Wing CEO from my district. I have participated in many workforce strategy meetings, and childcare is one of those things that is often discussed. And right now, when we look at if this funding is removed, if we as state legislators do not prioritize this funding, we are looking at more people leaving the workforce. You know, unfortunately, you know, there was another story that just in the last couple of weeks, a young couple, their in-home daycare suddenly closed. And all of a sudden, they went from having one of them to decide what are they going to do. And one of them gave their two-week notice. That is one more person out of the workforce because they cannot find daycare. And so, again, I would just ask us to prioritize this. Because the unintended consequences to our workforce down the road is really, it's very concerning. So thank you.
Next we have Chair Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative West, for carrying this bill in partnership with me. Representative Coulter has also done some really great work in the scholarship space over the years. And, you know, it's a fantastic program that helps so many families in Minnesota. I think, you know, you and I both share a commitment to this program and making sure that families can afford the high quality, safe care that they need and that they deserve. I think, you know, we find ourselves in a pickle, which we have been very open about throughout the entire time that the committee's been meeting. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I just wanted to address is that this funding does remain very critical, but this was designed as one-time funding. And so because there was, you know, during the surplus, we were able to get some money out the door. And I think that that was a really valuable way to utilize some of those excess funds. Now we're in a position where we have to tighten our belts a little bit and dig deep and try to figure out what we can do. I think that the committee, we're facing some really tough choices, like the administration alluded to earlier, making sure we get food in kids' bellies, that, you know, parents and kids have the care that they need, all the things that that we need to balance and figure out how best we move forward. So I think, I appreciate particularly some of the folks from the business community chiming in support of this program, and that we continue to get creative and look for ways that potentially down the line we can meld our systems into a program that best serves the children and families of Minnesota. And I think we've already had some of those conversations offline and over the past years. And so we were really, I think, moving in the right direction. And nobody, to borrow a line from former Chair Pinto, who will be joining us shortly, nobody wants to spend more on early childhood education than I do. And I want to do that. So we're looking for ways to figure out and to support families as best we can. But since we're in this tricky spot, you know, we all know what the reality is, and just really appreciate the families who have shared their experience, and that we have such an incredible subsidy program available in Minnesota, and to look for ways to expand and improve it going forward.
Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a little comment on what my wonderful co-chair said is meld our systems. That is one thing. When I actually have the spreadsheet, if you're wondering what I keep looking at, I'm looking at our children and family spreadsheet, and it's like, how many lines of budget items need to do the same thing is a question. And that's one nice thing about having two new chairs of the committee is we're not wed to any particular way of doing things. We're not doing that immediately, to be clear. But going forward, there is a lot of utility in focusing our funding. Rather than having random programs drop off or random programs continue, to have some consistency, because that's what I worry about here, is the $180 million that was allocated is a lot of money, or 190 I think it was, a lot of money to have one go away. Now, you could have families, I know there was talk about the families continuing it following the family the whole time, so even if their kid, even the funding stops, their kid still is funded through the one-time money, which I can agree that there's a lot of utility in doing that. But one thing that totally leaves off is somewhat related to Representative Sensor Murrah's comment on, well, we have to be concerned about the providers. And if these providers are looking at a complete fall-off of these kids, that's going to affect the availability of childcare. So this program's incredibly important. And considering the amount of money we've increased our state budget by, this was a big part of that, this is one of those pieces that I would really like to maintain. And it might sound strange for a Republican to be talking about more spending. I think our committee does best when Republicans talk about more spending and Democrats talk about deregulation. That's where we can find the beautiful peace in the valley. Like Representative Coulter's wonderful bill, which I still just can't wrap my mind around how much I like it. So this is the direction our committee is going to move. It's been very fun to focus on issues that are, one, exactly what I'm living with, but two, with a wonderful group of people. And when we look at the rest of the budget, we can't just leave things the way they are and let this fall off. I have stated at the beginning, we're not going to get to $90-some million unless Chair Khatiza Batoon has a great idea, and she can have all the credit if she finds a way to do that. That
the business community won't like that idea.
Well, okay, there is that. But when you look at all our spending, the one thing that when things automatically increase, it's very it gets budgets really bloated, and then it squeezes out a lot of really important investments. So I want to look at where can we go in this budget that doesn't reduce anything anybody's getting today, that keeps today constant, and we can keep that money for the state and put it into these early learning scholarships. So this bill has a lot of co-authors. There is even spots available as well, but I know it's a priority of the committee. So we can't let this money fall off. It's way too important. Our providers are relying on it. The families that get it right now get it great, but as has been brought up, there is a significant waiting list. So I really appreciate the committee's support of House File 470, and we will all work together to dig through this budget and make it where we can.
All right, thank you. If no further discussion, I'll take those as your final comments. And for the kids, it's laid over. The next we have House File 2643. And this bill will be laid over. And so, Chair West, if you would like to introduce your bill. And
thank you.
See, you have an amendment as well. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 2643 to be laid over.
Members, if we could kind of be quiet as we're exiting the room,
if
please.
If you're a provider, I would love your feedback on what I'm about to talk about, just so you know. So I'm not moving the amendment. This amendment's for discussion. But the A1 amendment that you'll see in your packets is something that struck me about 2 weeks ago, slightly less, is there was a single day, a Tuesday, where there are 8 violations of the background study in one day at a variety of providers, 8. And 5 of those generated fines. And a big focus of this committee is protecting our children in daycare, in childcare. And I had a bill earlier, House File 2226, that expanded the background study system, and Representative Sensenmura and Chair Katiza-Batun are working with me on that and have been tremendously helpful. There are some issues in making that bill work that we are still navigating. And then I thought, well, we had 8 days, I mean, one day where there were 8 violations of the background study. So if we expand the background study, it doesn't really do that much. Unless it is done. This bill also, amendment increases the fine for that from $200 to $500. One, because I think it's that important, and two, because I will dig and scratch and claw to find any dollar we can put to early learning scholarships. And this might generate that, considering, well, 5 fines in a single day would generate an extra, $1,500? Hopefully, this isn't a huge money maker because that means we have other problems. But one, this we could use that investment, and two, it's very important that childcare workers are indeed doing the background study. Okay, enough about that amendment, which was not moved. House File 2643 was a bill I drafted because of a conversation with a childcare provider. So. One interesting thing is when you look at people's license violations on their child care license, sometimes what it says, and we've talked about this in committee, it sounds horrible. It's like not giving kids nutritious food or even these other maltreatment situations might not be as bad as they sound when you see it on a licensing report. And I'm not going to specifically name the daycare because they gave me this story, but they had an instance where inadvertently they left a child outside for 9 minutes. Unacceptable. They didn't get caught. They self-reported that violation, which I think is a good thing that we should encourage providers to do. But you don't get any bonus points for self-reporting. Maybe you're less likely to get a fine, but for what prospective parents see when they look at your license, they see failure to give nutritious food or whatever the maltreatment or violation is. Now, I think part of our accountability system that we can build into this childcare is encouraging providers to police themselves rather than relying entirely on inspectors. We've heard a lot about the way inspections are done, Representative Coulter had this amazing bill standardizing inspections. And this will encourage our providers to both proactively police themselves, because now it's not an exclusively negative thing. Because this is something that still could come up, whatever violation occurs. But if you at least have some self-reporting designation, and that's the purpose of the bill, when a family looks at a provider's license that they might want to go to, they can see this violation was self-reported, which you can assess that as you will as a family member. But when I see a violation that sounds terrible that's self-reported, that would honestly make me feel a little better while I was shopping. And it would encourage our providers to police themselves. And I think it's a rather minor change. Now, I'd love to hear what the department, they don't have to give anything today, but I know there's some work around this issue the department's doing, and I would love for this to be included. Maybe we don't even need a bill, but to offer some sort of reprieve or option for these providers to indicate that whatever violation it is, they were the ones who brought it to the attention of the department. So that is the bill, and invite member questions.
All right. First, we'll ask if there's any public testimony. Seeing none, member questions. Representative Hicks.
Why are we not doing the amendment? I'm sorry, I was probably very distracted and did not understand.
Chair West.
Well, I was kind of embarrassed because it's like the fourth time I've forgotten this amendment. And my hope is to include it in our omnibus bill down the road, the amendment. And potentially this. But it really makes no difference. So then I was like, we don't need to go through that shameful song and dance.
So, yeah, Representative Hicks, he had forgotten to post it earlier. So it is in your packets in time, but we didn't put it up early enough. And
Chair Katizabatun did not say no or anything. It's just because it really fundamentally makes no difference, because we can still consider it, I just wanted to make sure we brought it up for discussion.
So we're just discussing it.
I would like to discuss it.
Representative Hicks.
Okay. Thank you. I also happen to feel very strongly in this space and in the human service space that background study compliance is something that really bothers me. I get very irritable when people don't follow background study rules. I think everyone should have to follow background study rules. I think it's good business practice. I think it prevents a lot of things that are unpleasant for everyone involved. And I have moved to the point of we have a deficit and I'm pro sticks. So this is me telling you that I am pro sticks in the place of background study compliance.
Yeah. Chair West.
Thrilled to hear that, Representative Hicks. Another thing I've discovered is how much we agree throughout our wonderful committee time on a lot of issues in this realm.
All right, Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to thank you for sort of thinking creatively about bringing information forward. I think one of the things that I have encountered in the work that I've done on licensing is how lack of information can really just breed concern on kind of all sides of the equation. And so I think this is a really intriguing approach to sort of add what I think would be a relatively minimal amount of information in terms of what folks would see on their computer screen, but probably would, I think, bring forward a lot of information and a lot of questions that folks would have as they're exploring child care centers for their kids. So, and I think it lends itself to a reasonable, you know, hopefully what would be a reasonable explanation. So I think it's just a really intriguing proposal and wanted to thank you for that. I also wanted to say that as uncomfortable as you are praising my bill, being a DFLer who got a letter of support from the Center for the American Experiment has given me no small amount of heartburn as well.
Okay. Thank you, Chair West.
I deliberately didn't bring that up specifically at the time.
Any other member questions? Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair West. I think anything that we can do to clarify
in situations like this, because it is the language for self-reporting is very similar to assisted livings and nursing homes. And in that lane, when you self-report, it does you get surveyed and get fined. And so to your point, it's very disheartening to the employees. You could have a fall with a fracture. You could have a million things that happen. But you're self-reporting, and I think that should be a piece that, that people understand, because there are guidelines, and you can't have situations of 100% perfection doesn't happen. But you want to have systems where you encourage people to self-report, and then you take care of it. And so I think when you're looking at correction orders, sometimes the goal is not fining, it's just education and making sure the system worked when they self-report. And then you correct it and you look at the scale of, is it isolated or is this a systemic situation that's happened more frequently? But I think it's a great idea, and I think it makes the workforce to feel appreciated in the way that they should. So thank you.
Chair West.
Are we ready to close out?
Or any, I didn't know if you had any follow-up. Any other, Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, just a question for the author. Because this is such a good bill and such a great idea, is this going to the General Register, or is it possibly laid over, Chair West?
Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative McDonald, not absolutely certain. It doesn't have a cost for the department to implement. So it'll be laid over today, just possibly included in the omnibus bill.
Representative McDonald, follow up?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right, any other questions? Seeing none, final comments, Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Representative Pinto here? I didn't.
Yeah, he's kind of hiding behind that.
Okay. All right. I was like, do I need to sit here and stall or?
No.
All right. So, thank you, members of the committee, for support of this concept. The background amendment I am particularly motivated by. I think it's something that should be heavily considered. And the self-reporting designation, with further discussions with the department on implementation, if it's something that we can do, it's definitely what I would like to see happen in our omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair West. With that, the bill is laid over.
Sorry for that brief delay. Representative Pinto, we sent an email clarifying this, and the Human Services Committee asked for us to send it there. So we will be moving House File 1367, referring House File 1367 to the Committee on Human Services.
And Mr. Chair, I would love the chance to explain why that may not be necessary, but anyway, we can have give it a pitch anyway, if the chair would be open to that pitch, but it sounds like that's at least where the motion is, and I'd love to make my pitch when the time arrives, so. Is this is the time?
Carpinto, two-year bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I guess we'll describe the bill maybe at the end before you do the motion. We can discuss the referral and see. I'll make my pitch at that point. And actually, before I get into the bill, I just, Mr. Chair and members, just wanted to note that this morning the Workforce Labor and Economic Development Committee, which I co-chair with Chair Baker, had a hearing on a really important workforce labor and economic development issue, which was child care and early learning, and had an entire, almost an entire session on that, a number of proposals, including from members of this committee. And I'm hopeful, Mr. Chair and Chair Katizabatun, that we may be able to, at a future date, even sort of get together a little bit in these committees, because this is a massive workforce and economic development issue. And so grateful to all of you, and certainly grateful hearing the proposal about scholarships, early learning scholarships, which is a big priority for me as well. So thank you so much. So House File 1367, pardon me, is a different topic, and it addresses a gap that our county attorneys in our state identified relating to abuse and molestation that children suffer when they are Minnesota residents but are temporarily out of state, and that there's a very concerning gap that arises in our ability to respond to abuse and maltreatment and molestation when children are in that situation out of state. I will have a testifier describe further, but I will point folks to this County Attorney's Association handout that describes information. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Ryder, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Ryder. I'm the Chisago County Attorney, and I'm here as a representative of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, specifically the Juvenile Law Committee, which members of the Juvenile Law Committee are members who represent our social service agencies in our respective counties. This bill before you is a priority of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and it provides, as Representative Pinto indicated, a technical change or a correction of a oversight or a glitch, I guess, in the law regarding the jurisdiction over maltreatment matters. The attorneys active in this area of practice identified this after bringing cases forward. Particularly, it started the conversation. They drafted this bill, and we've consulted with DCYF, and that's why you have the A1 amendment before you. Just to best describe what this means, it would be good to articulate an example that came before one of our counties, and to our dismay, it actually has taken place with several of our counties. One of those is that a family had traveled on vacation to Florida. While in Florida, the offender, who was a stepfather of the child, had sexually abused the child. And when the family returned to Minnesota, the family reported this abuse to their local welfare agency, their county social services. The social service agency investigated the maltreatment. They found that maltreatment or sexual abuse had in fact occurred, and they made a maltreatment determination. The offender, using his due process rights, brought an appeal, and this appeal came before a human services judge, and that judge reviewed the evidence, and it wasn't because there was lack of evidence of the maltreatment, but more so a lack of jurisdiction or ability to have jurisdiction over this maltreatment that occurred in another state. So what we had is a family where the child lived in Minnesota, the offender lived in Minnesota, and when this report comes to the social service agency, they investigate it, and their two objectives are to determine if maltreatment occurred and whether services are to be delivered to this family. In this case, the criminal justice system in Florida did not pursue charges, and that is within their own purview. But in Minnesota, if a maltreatment determination is upheld, this offender would be prohibited from having child-facing roles within our communities. They would be prohibited from being a coach, a teacher, a child care provider, as we've articulated. This, having a maltreatment determination on an offender who commits those acts outside of our jurisdiction is equally as important as having that jurisdiction over someone who commits those acts here in Minnesota. So that was the one case that brought to the attention of our committee. And to our dismay, as I said, there were several others that had indicated similar experiences where they found maltreatment, but it was overturned by a hearing judge. And while we talk about this in a more severe, egregious situation where a parent has committed sexual assault or sexual maltreatment against a child, this would also apply to those instances where maybe a parent late at night takes children over the border to another state to buy alcohol and has a child in the car, and we learn about a DWI stop in that adjacent state, and our county social service agencies would want to look into that. They would want to investigate whether that child was exposed to dangerous circumstances. Even those circumstances would not allow us to find a maltreatment determination or particularly offer services to that family. So what the amendment, A1 amendment, particularly does is that clarifies that it is the authority and the obligation of our local social service agencies to investigate or assess these scenarios.
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt you, but you're citing an amendment of which we do not have.
I'm sorry.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the testifiers, Ms. Ryder's referring, County Attorney Ryder's referring to the prior version of the bill. Okay. So, yeah, the amendment was already added in the prior committee. Yeah.
So just the...
Thank you, Chair Pinto.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Ryder.
My oversight. Thank you. So the in Section 2 of the bill specifically is the language that clarifies that it is the obligation of our local social service agency to investigate and assess these instances. And Section 1, which is in 240, amends 245, 256.045, would now allow a hearing officer to have jurisdiction over an appeal by a person who is alleged to have offended against a child. So we are asking that for the support of this bill. We think that is an important, fixes a glitch or oversight of our jurisdiction over these important matters. And we think that it would have a minimal impact. While these are important, and I'm not trying to diminish the significance of them, but we don't, from our juvenile law committee at the County Attorneys Association, we don't perceive this to be a huge volume of cases, so we don't believe that there would be a fiscal note or a significant financial cost to counties. With that, I'll leave it to questions or...
Thank you, Ms. Ryder. Do we have any members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? No. Any member questions? Representative Nadeau, very quickly, since we're out of school right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. I'm curious on line 2.28 of the bill, why you're striking the word immediately. From it's right before it's talking about a local welfare agency is responsible for immediately striking that conducting an assessment or investigation. These are mandated, you know, investigations and assessments. And I'm just curious as to why you would be striking that.
Ms. Ryder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nadeau. That change came after our consultation with DCYF. That intake and screening process is a little bit complicated, but in some instances, if the it gives the discretion to the social service agency, if the perpetrator does not have direct access to the child, it would not require an immediate investigation. It could be up to a 5-day time frame to initiate that investigation. So it's really we would still promptly or immediately investigate in some instances, but not in every. So I think that's just a cleanup to remove it from our current practices and the child maltreatment intake guidelines.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, I'm sure, because we're running out of time. Chair Pinto, are other states adopted this law that you were seeking?
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. I'm trying to recall if I feel like that question had come up in the prior committee and that we were looking into it. I think we found that there are a number of states. I feel like Florida, I may be getting my bills mixed up. I think believe the answer is yes, but I will admit to being a little bit uncertain about exactly which states and how many states represent McDonald. But I would think most states would, because of course this is a problem that would come up in states, right? You have a child who's a resident in one state and then they, you know, sometimes they are out of state temporarily, and we certainly want to make sure to close that loophole. I see even if other states aren't doing it, we certainly would want to make sure that we are, so our kids are protected.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, real quick. So kind of like reciprocity we have in other states where, you know, it would be a similar scenario possibly.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay, we're going to take this wrap up, and we're over our time, and we didn't ask our parents for permission to be out. So,
Dad,
we're going to lay the bill over rather than send it out.
Okay.
I think that is a nice compromise while we figure it out.
Okay.
But other member, answer that, and then we're going to lay over the bill.
Sure. Representative McDonald had a I'll just was going to answer the question, or we're all done. Yes.
Are you, Mr. Chair, is this an April Fool's joke, or are you serious?
I'm serious. Representative, well, I was just going to let you finish the thought, but we got to go. It's over 5 minutes.
Can you answer the question?
Do you want to answer the question?
I'm trying to wonder what the question was. Well, I'll talk to you about that.
This bill is laid over. The committee is adjourned.